Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
This interview was recorded before the Swiss Federal Council announced it was pulling out of the institutional framework agreement agreed with the European Union.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in European Studies. I'm Tim Jones, and my guest today is Paolo Dardanelli, co-editor with Oscar Mazzolini of Switzerland EU Relations, Lessons for the UK After Brexit, published in March by Routledge. Between voting to leave the European Union in 2016 and doing it last year, the British spent a long time debating which bilateral model they should adopt after withdrawal. Should it be Norwegian, Canadian, or even, said those who shouldn't know better, Australian? To investigate this question, Routledge have launched a four-book series called Dealing with Europe, edited by John Eric Fossum and Christopher Lord from the University of Oslo. And with the UK now both outside the Union and the broader 30-nation single market, the European Economic Area, or EEA, this series begins with the most tried and tested alternative model, Switzerland. Next year, it'll be 30 years since the Swiss voted by just 50.3% to 49.7% against joining the EEA. This decision was followed by three decades of on-off bilateral negotiations aimed at creating something almost but not quite entirely like the EEA relationship. In this book, Professors Dardanelli and Mazzolini pull together 10 specialists in Swiss-EU relations to examine the last 30 years, the bilateral agreements that replaced the EEA, the impact on domestic Swiss politics and society, and most of all, the lessons for the UK. Paolo Dardanelli is reader in comparative politics at the University of Kent and has held visiting appointments at Harvard, Cologne, Bern, and Madrid. He was educated at the Universities of Turin and Durham and at the London School of Economics. He's the author of Restructuring the European State, European Integration and State Reform in 2017, and before that, the increasingly relevant Between Two Unions, Europeanisation and Scottish Devolution, 2006. Paolo, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Can we start with some background to the Dealing with Europe series and the genesis of this book? What made Fossum and Lord decide to go first with Switzerland? How were you and your fellow editor chosen? And how did you choose your own contributors to the book?
Yeah, well, I mean, perhaps I should say that the original idea actually came from us. I mean, this is an issue that, of course, has been very prominent in Swiss politics over the last few years. And so we approached Routledge and we suggested doing a book on this. And Routledge thought that was a good idea. And was also it could be broadened to include also other countries like Norway. They are in a close relation with the EU, but outside the Union. So I should say, you know, we came first, as it were, and then this series was built to widen the perspective, and. We also did a book published in Switzerland a few years ago, in Italian actually, with a similar coverage, And I mean, of course, you know, from the perspective of domestic Swiss politics. And I was also involved years ago in a book edited by Clive Church on the same topic that was published in 2006.
Right. And are you both Swiss Italians yourselves?
Well, I'm Oscar is a Ticinese, so he's a Swiss Italian. I'm actually Italian, I'm not Swiss. Mm.
Right. I thought so, looking at your university background, but I wasn't sure. Yes. Well, someone in the book, I forget who it was, but someone describes the Swiss as belonging to a subset of quote, reluctant Europeans. And yes. I mean, the similarities with the UK seem to jump out. And one of the writers, René Schwok, points out that both economies are very open, but at the same time have political cultures that are highly protective of national identity and sovereignty. Was that really the underlying reason for making the comparison?
In a way, yes. I mean, we pointed out in the book that if you look at the UK and Switzerland, in their relations with the European Union, you see a lot of similarities over the years. You know, going back to the 1950s, they refused to take part in the early steps of European integration, and then followed in. Quite a similar fashion for about 20 years. Then what we pointed out was that the UK seems to deviate from this by joining the EU, whereas Switzerland stayed outside. And now with Brexit, they're back together. And the underlying, the background situation is the one that you described, whereby they're very open economies. They have a tradition of sort of free market support, liberal economies in a way. And but then the political culture is very protective of sovereignty for different reasons. Of course, in Switzerland there was and there still is the tradition of neutrality that played an important role in the early phase, which of course is not the case in the UK. But for different reasons, this concern with protecting their autonomy and sovereignty has been very prominent, and there's been one of the compass points that has guided the policy of the two countries vis-a-vis the EU.
Yeah, well, I probably like the conversation to follow the pattern of the book or the structure of the book, which I presume was structured in such a way that it makes sense. Can I put it that way? So if we start with the chapter by Georg Kreis about Switzerland, I mean, essentially what was Switzerland's 2016 moment, which was Black Sunday on December the 6th, 1992, and the background to it. Can you give us the historical background to that chapter and the events of 1992?
Yeah, so the long term background is the one that I was referring to earlier. So essentially, when European integration got going in the 1950s, this was seen as encroaching on Swiss sovereignty. So Switzerland was not interested in joining, was also perceived to be incompatible with neutrality. Now, neutrality in Switzerland has been understood in different ways over time, but that was the understanding at that time. Of course, Switzerland at that time was still outside the United Nations. So it was a very sort of solitary country in a way. And so that's the long-term background. Switzerland, together with the UK, set up what is now EFTA, the European Free Trade Association, in the early 60s, precisely as a way of integrating economies along a path that would not involve political integration of the type pursued by the EU. So that was the long-term background. Then when the UK left EFTA to join the European communities at the time, then obviously that changed completely the framework for Switzerland. And then so Switzerland signed a free trade agreement with the European communities in 1972. Again, as a way of not sort of being isolated economically from the European market. And then the more immediate background to 1992 was the acceleration of integration, at the end of the 1980s. So you had the single market program. This was launched, the original idea, in 85, 86. You had the single European Act signed in 87. So there was this drive to deepen European integration with the single market program that also started to attract the interest of countries like Sweden, Austria, Finland, that they were also outside the European Union, and Norway. And so Switzerland was facing this acceleration of European integration, and so was facing this challenge of what to do. Obviously still highly protective of its sovereignty and concerned about neutrality and so on, at the same time not, of course, be willing to suffer economically too much. And so Switzerland took part in the negotiations to create the EEA and eventually the establishment in Switzerland, or most of the establishment, was in favor of joining the EEA. And for some, this was a stepping stone to joining the EU itself. And we mentioned in the book that actually in the course of the campaign to ratify the EEA agreement in Switzerland, actually Switzerland applied to join the EU. And that was a factor, arguably, in the outcome in the referendum. But in a nutshell, that's the background.
Mm. Yeah, one thing I'd forgotten actually was that it was at the end of 1992, and it was in the same year where the Danes voted against the Maastricht Treaty, and the French came very close to voting against the Maastricht Treaty. So there was also a sort of permission structure for the Swiss to vote against something. Do you think that was quite influential?
It is possible. It is possible. Kreis mentions that factor in his chapter. So it is possible. We know that there is in political science we call it a demonstration effect, whereby when you have a series of votes, there is influence from one vote to the other. So it is quite possible. We do know that at the time, also that was also the time of the negotiation of the Maastricht Treaty, the commitment to essentially set up the euro. So there was this acceleration of integration, and it started to sort of, I would say, raise alarm bells, in different quarters. So there was we witnessed the start of a backlash against that. So it is entirely possible. I mean, we don't really have a way of establishing it for sure, but it is quite possible that there was an effect there.
Well, he also discusses the voting patterns and the rise of Christoph Blocher, but we'll come back to those because they're more important actually in some of the later chapters. So the next stage, really, that the scene setting is the chapter by Sergio Rossi and Guillaume Vallée on the economics and the sort of background on what happened next. So they talk about this situation of 60 years of integration without membership, where Switzerland essentially has no choice but to be deeply integrated, simply due to geographical proximity and mutual independence. Again, could you give us some of the background to this chapter?
So Switzerland, of course, is because of its geography, is located right in the center of Europe, has always been highly integrated with the European economy, the wider European economy. This integration is particularly important for Switzerland because Switzerland is an exporting country, is a high wage economy, so very competitive in certain sectors, highly specialized in certain sectors where it is very competitive, so it relies a lot on these export markets. So that has always been the background. So Switzerland has always been careful not to damage its economic prospects by being cut off from the European market, and that I was mentioning before led to the signing of this free trade agreement in 1972, and then later to the attempt to join the EEA and then the development of the bilateral agreements. So that's always been the case. On the other hand, for example, there are sort of two main aspects. One is that Switzerland enjoys this, if you want, a comparative advantage in terms of the stability and the predictability of its political system. Is a very highly stable political system, and has been very attractive to investors because of that. And again, Switzerland has been concerned not to sort of to damage that by potentially being dependent politically from decision by the European Union. And this affects, in particular, of course, the currency. The Swiss franc is perhaps the most solid currency in the world, and is an element of the comparative advantage of Switzerland in economic terms. And again, the prospect of having to adopt the euro, replace the franc with the euro, is very problematic for Switzerland. So this is all part of the picture and part of this desire to have access to the European market, so not to be cut off from the market, but to minimize the political sort of fallout of that integration, as it were, as much as possible. That's the fundamental trade-off that Switzerland has tried to navigate since the 1950s, really. What I could say, and this is something also that is relevant for the UK, is that the integration of the Swiss economy with the wider European economy has lessened a little bit over time, in the sense that with this transition from a primarily manufacturing economy, with the secondary sector being the dominant sector, to a more tertiary-based economy, then Switzerland find it more easy to trade with Asia, for example, or with the US or with the rest of the world, and is a bit less dependent on the European market than it was before. And so if you want, that need to that desperate need to be integrated with the European markets become a little bit less pressing, and the UK has found itself in the same situation. We saw the other day in the news that imports from outside from elsewhere in the world they overtaken imports from the EU. So that's a general pattern there, and once again Switzerland sort of is mirroring what is happening in the UK.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com.
NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting though. I mean, so the economic background really led to this push for this series of bilateral agreements beginning in 1993 to 99. And focused on key areas like transport, public procurement, agriculture. But interestingly, again, compared to the UK, is the second round of bilateral negotiations, and this is all covered in the chapter by René Schwok, focused on the Schengen Agreement and the Dublin Agreement on asylum, which, of course, is arguably the main motivator for the UK leaving or voting to leave the EU in 2016. Mm-hmm. So how was it that a country that had similar issues with immigration and free movement was so open pretty early on in the discussions, you know, just 10 years in, to talking about the Schengen Agreement and the Dublin Agreements?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question in a way. I mean, now Switzerland, sort of was a country welcomed a lot of immigrants, you know, in the 50s and 60s and 70s, but less in the 70s. But they were mainly from other European countries. So in a way, there was a tradition there. I mean, it is. I guess it's a little bit difficult to say why exactly that was the case. I mean, of course, the two dynamics are different. So, I mean, we were saying at the beginning that, you know, there are a lot of similarities between the situation of Switzerland and the UK. Now, of course, the key difference is that Switzerland, as from a situation of being outside, has moved closer and closer to the EU. Whereas, of course, you know, the UK joined and then got out. So the direction of travel, at least for a certain period, were very different. So I guess that is one is part of the answer. Other elements there are that one is the you know, of course, the geographical location of the country. Switzerland, of course, is bang in the middle of the, is an island really entirely surrounded by EU territory, whereas the UK, of course, never joined Schengen, even when it was a member of the EU. So that in a way, that in a, when the UK was a member, that was the paradox in a way. The UK was a member of the EU but was outside Schengen. Switzerland was not a member of the EU but was inside Schengen. And I think the geographical location plays a role there, partly also because it's not just the geographical location in general, is the fact that you have very important economic centers like Geneva and Basel, which are right on the border. Their economic hinterland goes into the other country. If you fly to Basel, the airport is in France. So in a way, that is is a difference from the UK. So Switzerland is, if you want, has no choice but to be highly integrated there. And I guess a third element is that, of course, when Switzerland was negotiating these agreements with the EU, was of course in a weaker position than the UK. I mean, Switzerland is much smaller, more dependent on the European market, and so on. And the EU has always taken the position that the freedom of movement is a quid pro quo for access to the market. You know, the EU has always taken the view that you have four freedoms. You know, one of the freedoms is movement of workers, and so the freedom of goods, you know, has to go, or services has to go with that. And so I guess, you know, so the combination of these factors, and I would say in particular, the geographical location of the country has perhaps the decisive factor that explained this difference. And of course, the last thing perhaps is to say that, of course, I mean, as you mentioned, in the UK, the sensitivity of immigration was a key factor in Brexit. So it would have been sort of almost unthinkable for the UK then to negotiate a post-Brexit agreement that would remove that sort of control over borders.
Mm. Well, having said what I said, free movement and immigration essentially became the reason that the bilateral agreement approach reached its sort of limit in 2014 with the popular initiative for a vote on freedom of movement, which then led to a vote against, again, a very narrow one. There seems to be something in Switzerland about 50.3%. It's even narrower than the one we had here. And that essentially led to this final stage of the bilateral negotiations where the EU decided it was tired of having these, I think it's 120 agreements now, difficult to manage them, and they wanted to integrate it all into an institutional framework agreement, which at the same time has become a bigger and bigger problem for Swiss politics, which is something that you run through in your chapter with Blaise Fontanellas. Can you talk us through the background to what I just mentioned?
Yes. So as you said, you are, the current situation, you have this series of treaties, bilateral agreements. I mean, these are obviously very complex to manage, because they are all the legal basis of them is all slightly different. Some of them, the first set of agreements are tied to each other, so denouncing one agreement triggers potentially also the cancellation of the others, whereas the other ones are not. So it's a very complex set of agreements, and the EU has been not happy with them for some time. I mean, it is probably fair to say that Brexit has also alerted the EU to be a bit more watchful of what Switzerland does, and so the perception from the EU is that Switzerland has got away, perhaps if not with murder, with quite a lot, by exploiting a little bit this complexity, exploiting the fact that the EU has been quite so understanding that Switzerland finds itself in a difficult situation because of the system of direct democracy. There is the Swiss leaders cannot really commit to a course of action if they don't think there is a chance that this will be approved by the people. So the design on the part of the EU is to streamline, to simplify this agreement, this set of agreements, and to replace it with a single agreement would be a framework agreement. So setting the fundamental rules there and that would replace and would sort of be a framework that could go could support the relations in the medium term and long term. Now, that sounds fine, and Switzerland has accepted somewhat reluctantly to engage with that process, and there is a draft agreement now on the table. I mean, there are a few problems there, and the one fundamental problem is that the EU has always requested that Switzerland adapts its legislation to the evolving set of laws of the European Union, and sort of would like this to be a virtually automatic process. Mm. Now, that is problematic for Switzerland because it's perceived to be essentially a surrender of sovereignty, in the sense that the Switzerland would just be there waiting for Brussels to decide and then change its laws. And at the moment, if you want, the situation is not terribly different, but there is this semblance of still a degree of autonomy in deciding how to transpose legislation and so on. So that's one element. The other element that has also as a partisan sort of dimension is that the freedom of movement for EU workers in Switzerland is not the equivalent of, let's say, a French worker moving to Germany, because the sort of the welfare entitlements that person has, and in terms of salary and so on, they are not the same. So there is Switzerland still has a system of essentially protecting its workforce from competition from EU workers, and this again is partly due to geography, whereby as I was saying earlier, in Geneva or Basel, you can be based in France and be a cross-border commuter and work in Switzerland, and many people do that. The same goes for Ticino, from the Milan area, and so on. So and this is a significant problem for Switzerland, because the difference in salaries is huge, and so potentially you have this very serious competition from EU workers, to the Swiss workers. So the partisan sort of dimension of that is that in the Swiss sort of party system, the party on the left, which is called Socialist Party, which would be the equivalent of the Labour Party in the UK, over the last, let's say, 15-20 years, has been the most consistent supporter of Switzerland's integration in the EU, primarily for reasons of internationalism and openness to Europe and the world. But at the same time, of course, this is a party that wants to protect the interest of the working class, and the framework agreement as it stands poses a challenge for the party. So the party has signaled that does not intend to recommend ratification of that agreement, which implies that there is virtually no chance that if the agreement is put to a referendum, there is virtually no chance that it will be approved. So the paradox is that, this closing the agreement has created a de facto, if you want, alliance between the left and the right, for different reasons, but against the agreement, depriving it of sufficient support among the electorate.
It's interesting, though, because I saw a poll last week that showed that if the IFA were put to the Swiss people, apparently they claim that they would vote 64% to 32% in favor of it. And then, of course, we had the experience of the sort of second thoughts referendum last year on freedom of movement. Do you believe that poll, and B, do you think that there is a sort of change of sentiment going on in Switzerland?
I would say that seems to me optimistic, in the sense that traditionally in Switzerland, sort of the indication given by the political parties is important. So in the current situation, it seems to me difficult that would be the result in a referendum. I mean, the other aspect to bear in mind, but we don't know to what extent that can play out in a vote, is that what is clear is that in Switzerland the people are, or the majority of the people is supportive of keeping links with the EU. They don't, if the choice is down to, keeping complete control of sovereignty and sort of breaking relations with the EU, that is not what people, that's something that, the right-wing party, the Swiss People's Party, would be prepared to do, but this is not what the majority of the people would be prepared to do. But I mean, on the current political landscape, I would find it very difficult to imagine a vote of that sort of magnitude in favor.
Yeah. Well, actually, on the voting side, to me, the most interesting things would, I mean, you've got four chapters, one by Pascal Sciarrini, one by Sean Muller, Tobias Tyler, and Oscar Mazzoleni, all looking at the breakdown of the voting and the similarities with the breakdown of voting in the UK. So the more pro-European areas tend to be the Francophone areas, the large cities, even if they were German-speaking, a higher education level. And what really struck me was that one of the most Eurosceptic areas is Ticino, is the Italian-speaking canton in the south. Yeah. Can you talk us through that? It's very interesting similarities and also differences with the situation in the UK.
Yes. What we have found is that in terms of the difference between the French-speaking areas, the German-speaking areas, that has been quite consistent over time. It was a very sharp gap at the time of the 1992 vote. The gap is a little bit less sharp now, but there is a consistent difference in terms of the French-speaking area being more pro. There is an interesting question of why that should be the case, and some of the chapters touch upon it. That there is, if you want, a cultural dimension to it. One element of that is that French-speaking Swiss, they tend to quite like France, and they get on well with France, although they, we need to be clear that they are not identifying with France. They're very proud to be Swiss, but there is, if you want, a positive attitude to France, and there is a close cultural integration in the sense that, for example, French speaking Swiss, they speak virtually standard French and so on. The situation is different in German-speaking Switzerland. There is a fear, I would say, of Germany. For example, German immigrants, they tend to not to be welcome. Why that should be so, Tyler in the book argues that partly is linguistic, because there is a strong attachment to the dialect in Switzerland, which is very different from standard German, but then the written language is standard German and so on. So there is an interesting area to explore, but certainly that is very clear in terms of the linguistic factor. The other factor that is very similar to the UK is the urban versus rural pattern, with the urban areas being in favor, rural areas against, and the education factor. So that's very clear. Ticino is an interesting one, because it wasn't particularly Eurosceptical in the past, but it's become more so over time. I think there the key factor, as Mazzoleni shows, is that its proximity with Italy. And Ticino is a periphery within Switzerland, is the only canton which is Italian speaking, is to the south of the Alps, so it's a little bit sort of isolated from the rest of Switzerland, doesn't have big cities, and is very close to the dominant economic area of Italy, which is the Milan area. And also Italy, of course, is a country with significant economic problems, for example, high unemployment. So the pressure from Italian, for example, cross-border commuters, on the Ticino labor market is very, very severe. And that arguably is the key factor that has made Ticino more and more Eurosceptic. And this has been exploited by a party, a regional party that was set up around the time of the EEA vote, and the party that has exploited this fear of Europe, which also in Ticino is primarily a fear of Italy. So you have these factors, you know, playing a role. I was mentioning earlier, by the way, that, you know, Geneva and Basel, they're very close to the border, but they, because they are important economic center, they sort of dominate, you know, the relative, you know, the surrounding areas in let's say France and Germany. Whereas in Ticino is the opposite, is the dominance of Milan, you know, vis-a-vis Ticino. So that partly also explains the difference between, let's say, Basel and Geneva on the one hand and Ticino on the other. We mentioned briefly in the book that an interesting difference. So these are all sort of broadly speaking similarities. You have some similarities in the UK, of course, with the difference, you know, in Scotland and Northern Ireland. Mm. In the attitude to the EU, you know, vis-a-vis London. So you have this triangulation, as it were, for example, in Scotland, whereby the attitude to the EU, they are governed to an extent by the attitudes to London. And we have seen that obviously playing out very, very significantly also, you know, as we speak. I was saying, you know, a key difference that we haven't explored too much in the book, because it doesn't come out very clearly in you know, in the analysis over time, but there is some indication that is present, is the effect of age, whereby in the UK it's very clearly that there is you know, an age effect, whereby younger people are much more pro-EU than older people. And there is some indication that in Switzerland it's actually the other way around, which is interesting. We don't really understand why that should be the case. And it would be interesting then, of course, you know, in the long term to see how that plays out.
Mm. Well, another contrast is something you pick out in your chapter on state structures, where you say that Europeanization has tended to feed a sort of centralization process in Switzerland, but that the cantons have protected their powers to extend or pushed back. And then you say, quote, Brexit raises challenges primarily of a disintegrative kind. The policy response called for is nonetheless similar, hence Switzerland still holds valuable insights for the UK. Can you explain what those insights would be?
Yeah, I mean, as you hinted at, in Switzerland, the attempt to sort of deal with this with the centralizing effect of European integration has been to associate the cantons more closely to foreign policy and European policy in particular. So traditionally, of course, under a classic federal system, foreign policy was exclusively a federal competence, so the cantons were not involved. And the challenge, this centralization challenge, emerged precisely because European integration, of course, you know, covers so many areas that domestically are a cantonal competence, but then the cantons didn't have a say in European policy. So the answer has been to, there was a constitutional change, there was a law passed, and then there has been a mechanism put in place whereby the cantons are much more closely associated with the federal government in formulating the foreign policy, the European policy of the country, and they can have observers, for example, in Brussels, and so on. So there has been a real effort to you know, to integrate the cantons into the decision making process, and arguably that is a lesson for the UK, because we have seen also in terms of, you know, when the UK repatriated some of the powers of you know, state aid and so on, there was an uproar in Scotland and Wales, because that was perceived as a power grab by London. So arguably, and we have seen also the situation in Northern Ireland, where Northern Ireland, you know, the protocol has you know, achieved the rare feat of, you know, sort of angering both communities for different reasons. So in a way, the lesson there is that a much closer integration of Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland in formulating what the UK policy vis-a-vis Europe should be is important. You know, precisely in terms of managing, you know, the problems that you know, withdrawing from the US created, and you know, the lesson from Switzerland that we can see is that this, you know, to, I mean, it doesn't, you know, it's not a perfect solution. It doesn't address all the problems, but it goes a significant way, you know, towards addressing them.
Well, just a final substantive question, which is on the the period coming up. So there's a Swiss election in 23, British election in 23 or 24, and then a big turnover of the European institutions in 24. Do you think there's an opportunity for doing something more global that could incorporate both states? So, you know, democratizing the EEA and trying to bring in both countries as part of a bigger effort to create a sort of two-speed European space, or is that too ambitious in your view?
My sort of gut reaction is to say yes, that sounds too ambitious, to be honest. I mean, this has been, you know, these ideas of multiple speed and you know, sort of concentric circles have been discussed for a number of years. They haven't come to much, really. I mean, to be honest, I don't see that changing, you know, in the foreseeable future. I mean, partly also because, you know, I mean, if you take a country like Switzerland, elections don't really make a fundamental change because, you know, all federal executives, they are, you know, multi-parties. There is a high degree of continuity there. The concerns that Switzerland has at the moment, for example, vis-a-vis this framework agreement, they are not likely to go away. I mean, the UK, of course, we don't know, but I mean, you know, the chances of Labour winning the next election, I think they are at the moment, from what we can see, not very high. So I would say, you know, really, sort of the stars don't seem to be aligned at the moment to indicate, you know, the likelihood of that sort of scenario materializing.
Well, finally, as usual, I've asked my guests to recommend two books, often but not always, something broadly in their field and one personal choice. So, Paolo, what have you gone for?
Okay, so I was mentioning earlier that it depends how the field is defined. I mean, if we take the field in terms of, you know, the study of politics and history more broadly. So the first one I would say is a book called How Democracies Die, which is not a very cheerful title, of course. So apologies for those who prefer to read lighter stuff. But it's an interesting book. It is a book by Levitsky and Ziblatt, the two American political scientists. Essentially, is about democratic erosion in Western countries. You know, focused particularly on the US, you know, was triggered by the Trump election. But we have seen also, you know, the aftermath of the election in the US, and we have seen also, you know, there are some warning signs in the UK as well. We have seen, of course, you know, situation in places like India, in places like Hungary, and so on. So there are, I would say, you know, worries about, you know, this erosion of democracy in many places in the world, even in places like, you know, the US that like to think of itself as the, you know, as the cradle of democracy. So that's the first one. A bit more in my field, I would recommend. It's quite a short book, so easy to read, quick to read, but I would recommend it. The other book takes a much more sort of longer-term frame and is not strictly in my field because it's a book of history. It's written by Norman Davis, prominent historian, called Vanished Kingdoms. And the title is a little bit misleading because it covers different parts of the world that they are not strictly speaking, kingdoms. And he once explained that he gave kingdoms, he put kingdoms in the title because his publisher said, well, that sounds better. So, it's gonna sell better. And this is essentially, as the title sort of hints at, is a book that looks at political system that existed in the past and then disappeared, so they're no longer there. We tend to sort of look back to history from today's standpoint, and so we take for granted that the system that exists now, existed in the past, but there were many systems in the past that then disappeared in the course of time. And so that is a reminder, if you want, again, perhaps not the most cheerful, but is written very well, very, very lively. And is a reminder of, how temporary political systems are, and they are not sort of destined to last forever.
Right. Well, thank you for your choices. Today, I've been talking to Paolo Dardinelli about Switzerland-EU relations, Lessons for the UK After Brexit, published in March by Routledge. Paolo, thanks again for coming on.
Thank you very much, Tim.